July 3rd, 1996. We're at 301
South Frio
Suite 8
480.
Interviewing Walter Martinez, presently Democratic Party County Chair, former City Councilman, former State Representative.
Correcto.
So let's start off with biography, and then we talk about your political career, then we talk about issues.
Okay.
And the state of Mexican-American politics. Who is Walter Martinez? Parents, grandparents, wife, children, relatives, where did they come from, when?
Okay. I guess my history starts with growing up on the west side of San Antonio. You know, my parents were divorced since I was very young. Although I continued contact with both my parents. I was raised by my grandparents, Rosaura Martinez and Cecilio Martinez. My grandfather just died last year. He lived to be 97 years old. My grandfather was from Jalisco, Mexico, Los Altos de Jalisco. So I love that song when I hear it in a local bar. But my two sisters, one younger, 2 years younger, Rosemary, and my sister Gloria, 1 year older. So it was three of us, and our grandparents raised us. My father was involved in our growing up, and my mother to some extent, and at a later point in life. We went to school on public schools on the near west side of San Antonio.
What years were these? When were you born?
I was born in 51, and went to public schools on the west side, Frank Johnson Elementary, Cooper Junior High School, and then Lanier High School, graduated from Lanier High School in 1970. This was, you know, during the Vietnam War, the hippie movement. My younger sister, Rosemary, ended up leaving to California to live with my mother when she got out of junior school. And that was quite a shock. It's an interesting conversation now. Her going from the west side of San Antonio to Hollywood High School, and then graduating from Hollywood High during the hippie era. I just came from California and visited her, and that was quite a trip, you know, that, of course, she's never left California, she's still there. Gloria stayed here, and then lived in Chicago for a while, lived in Los Angeles for a while. Of the three of us, Gloria's the only one that has had kids. We're real proud of both her kids. One of the little girl, well, her little girl, Sandy, is attending Lanier High School next year, and her biggest boy, Fernando Martinez Luján, is a second year cadet at West Point. He was raised by both my sister and my mother, his grandmother. And Fernando went to public schools and ended up graduated from Churchill High School, got into ROTC and drill team type of thing activities, and ended up getting accepted to Columbia, Cornell, and decided to go to West Point.
A couple of minor points. Your grandparents, when did they cross over? Do you know?
Yeah, my grandparents came to the U.S. Well, my grandfather came with his three sisters fleeing the revolution. His three sisters, my great aunts, Petra, Guadalupe, and Guillerma, and came here with their parents, my great grandfather, Pedro, around 1914. Went from Jalisco to Taylor, Texas. Worked for about a year and a half in the agricultural area, and then because they had a sister of my great grandfather's that was living here in San Antonio, aquí en la calle Guadalupe,
already
decided to come to San Antonio. They arrived here, started living with the sister here off of Guadalupe Street. And not too long thereafter, my grandfather was able to put some money down on you know, 50 cents down on three lots, four lots, aquí en la calle Chihuahua y Brazos.
And that's where you grew up in that home that he built?
I grew up a block away in the second, in their second home once they had moved from there at Brazos in Tampico.
Was Spanish your primary language at that time?
It was mixed, really, because my grandmother would talk to us in English and Spanish, and my grandfather would primarily talk in Spanish.
Okay.
But my grandfather would read the newspaper. You know, up to, he died at 97, he probably read in the newspaper up to 90 without any glasses and could read in English, but would, speak mostly in Spanish with a little broken English.
Okay, well, getting back, I just want to pick up those details. Your
they
early
came
childhood,
here.
Your school?
We went to a public school. I got involved in sports in junior high school. We had a pretty, my grandparents were very disciplined people. They, I remember that my upbringing was very strict, very disciplined. I mean, to the point that, for example, I don't think it was until high school that I was allowed to go play at the playground, you know. I mean, it was almost all, you know, if you want to play, it's within the family, it's here on the compound, it's, you know, that sort of thing. My grandmother pretty much ran the house. During that time, my dad was working in a business exporting and importing aircraft parts to Central America. He was gallivanting all over Central America for about 8 years. And I would see him, you know, he'd come in and be here for 4 months overhauling aircraft engines and then put them on a flatbed 18-wheeler that I recall, drive it all the way through Mexico into Central America, install the engines, overhaul them, fly the planes, and for the crop dusting.
In retrospect, don't you think that's incredible?
Oh, it's incredible. I mean, I wanted
brokering the customs. And
I wanted to go with him. He had this business that, and I just got back from a trip to El Salvador. He had promised me he would take me one day to Central America with him. Well, 8 years passed and I never went with him. But recently, the U.S. government, U.S. Information Agency, invited me to go to El Salvador to visit with mayors from across the country. And in fact, I visited with 65 mayors out of the 264 mayors there are in the country to talk about urban issues, urban problems, urban development, and it was interesting to be there. And even to find that some of the things that my dad had told me about, and even some of the families, descendants, are there today in Central America. I found common, I didn't meet them directly, but I found indirectly that the families were still there. He gave me some names and I went to look them up, and the descendants are still there.
Is this by chance connected to a project with Southwest Voter?
No, this was just a project.
This is on your own?
Yeah, it's on my own that somehow I was referred by some folks, and they were looking for someone who had municipal government experience, and they're going through their democratization, and after 12 years of civil war, they're trying to decentralize their government and those kinds of things. So we went to talk about some of the basic issues confronting cities. But anyway, our growing up was pretty simple. Pretty much con los primos and familia on the west side. I got into sports at Lanier High School. I tried a little bit of basketball. I was worthless. So what do? You go, you join ROTC. You know, what else can you do? I ended up pursuing a pretty active career in the drill team. My sister Gloria graduated a year ahead of me. She was primarily active in homemaking classes and those kinds of things. Rosemary, as I told you, was the free spirit in the family. She took off to California. We kept in touch by visits, periodic visits, and then by phone and by letter. Eventually, my mother returned us to Texas. When I started getting involved in, let me just say this before I leave school. I was never involved politically within the school system. What I mean by that is that I didn't run for class president. I didn't run for student council. I didn't do any of that.
Were you aware of your immediate environment? I would take it that this would be the 70s or the 80s?
Yeah, exactly.
And by that time, I guess when you were in middle school, walkouts had occurred in your schools.
We had a walkout at Lanier in 1968 or 69, I think. And former Senator Joe Bernal came and gave us...
Were you involved with that?
Yeah, I was. I was not one of the leaders, but I got involved with Edgar Lozano and with Steve Castro, Danny Hernandez, and a number of my contemporaries today. They were the leaders, Castro, and I remember Edgar Lozano, Hellraiser, and I have. I went to school with Edgar since the first grade. But what happened was that my dad had gotten me involved in campaigns since I was 15 years old. So I was involved with a campaign during that time, during high school, of campaigns like Senator Joe Bernal, Dr. D. Ford Nielsen for the city council to break the GGL, the Good Government League.
What did your dad do?
My dad is an entrepreneur. As I told you, during my elementary years, he was gallivanting to Central America.
No, I mean, but what did he do in this political campaign, sir? How did he get you involved?
Well, all these were friends and political associates that he knew of for many years. He had worked with them, helped them, supported, etc. You know, he and Chema, Joe Bernal, went to school together. They graduated from Lanier. So he knew, these are all his contemporaries from his school years. Rudy Esquivel, who ran for the legislature and won in the early days when he had to run at large, countywide. Juan DeFord, who ran for the city council, also the maverick kind of left-wing kind of movement that was against the current establishment, which was the McAllister GGL years. Those were the campaigns I was involved in. So I was in high school, but involved politically outside. So I never ran for anything in high school. I remember I was, and then I started working when I was, you know, when I left Cooper Junior High School, the first thing I wanted to do, in fact, I had been nagging my grandmother, I wanted a job, I wanted to work, because I wanted money.
For what?
Well, to be able to buy clothes, to be able to, you know, to have money to do your things that you want to do. You know, you don't want to just be dependent on somebody.
Are we thinking bicycle or are we thinking car already?
Bicycle. My first job was at a pharmacy. This is kind of funny. Del Mar Pharmacy. And the owners were Hispanic professionals that were pharmacists. They were contemporaries of my dad. Again, Jesse Camacho, an all-state basketball champion from Lanier High School during the Lanier's heyday in basketball. Jesse Camacho owned the pharmacy, along with Jesus Garcia from San Diego, his partner, and they owned five stores. That was my first job. I remember reporting to work the first day, and I'm at Del Mar Pharmacy here on 24th Street. At the Tamez Clinic, Dr. Richard Tamez Clinic. And had never worked before, had never had, you know, contact with the public in terms of how do you approach the public and just what I knew at home in terms of in school. So I guess I'm 15 years old and I report to work and I know that Jesse Camacho tried to check me out right away. And he's behind the counter, you know, doing his pill rolling, and I'm sitting over here. And a lady walks in, he says, why don't you take care of the lady? And I said, okay, you know, so I get up and stand at the counter of the cash register, and the lady comes up, and I said, yes, you know, can I help you? And the lady says, yeah, I want this bottle of Anacin. And I said, okay. I look at Jesse, she wants this bottle of Anacin. Well, go ahead and ring it up. Just, you know, take care of it. Give her a cash ticket. Bing.
Foreign words.
What is cash ticket?
How do you make the machine work?
You know, and it's, but Jesse was just, you know, look, you just write cash up here, put the date, one bottle of Anacin, look at the tax here, ring it up here, boom. That was my introduction to, so I worked at Del Mar all through high school and even after high school, off and on, you know, between drill team practice and, you know, had very flexible hours, but did everything from cleaning shelves, mopping floors, to eventually, you know, helping him with the pharmaceutical, with pricing, with, you know, the whole works.
Any thoughts at this time? When do you recall your first thoughts about what you wanted to be? Here you're surrounded by, well, candidates for public office, pharmacists, doctors,
Yeah.
I assume lawyers, Esquivel was a lawyer.
Yeah.
Your dad involved in Central America, aircraft engines.
There was, during the time that I was working at the pharmacy, there was encouragements and there was thought given to, you know, going to pharmacy school. I got encouragement to go to law school by many of my friends and that my dad's friends that was around politically. I definitely started thinking about going to college, but I was not real eager. I wasn't a bookworm. I really was not a, you know, in fact, what ended up happening is that I graduated from Lanier, ended up going to Tulane University for one semester, and then decided that I wasn't ready to go to college. I wasn't comfortable. I didn't like it. I wasn't ready to hunker down and hit the books. Really, I also think I missed my varied life.
Now, why Tulane? I mean, that's unusual, don't you think?
My dad made some contact where somehow we ended up with a part scholarship to go to Tulane. So it was part loan, part scholarship. And in fact, two of us from Lanier went, myself and a buddy of mine who was also pursuing or looking at going to college. So that's how we ended up at Tulane. It was an interesting experience. I wasn't ready. And I didn't go back. We went into the fall semester. I'm sorry, the spring semester. So we went in at the half year. Things weren't lined up, and you know, I wasn't preparing for, you know, making sure you had all of your documentation paperwork in line. So we ended up going in one semester late. I did that spring semester, earned a few credits, hours, and decided not to go back. Ended up here, went back to work, I believe at the pharmacy, and around that time I started getting involved again politically. I think I missed that in school. In fact, what ended up happening overall is that I ended up going back to school later when I chose to go. I attended school part-time. It took me 10 years to get my bachelor's degree. During all those 10 years, working politically, holding a job, getting involved in campaigns, and juggling all three things.
What school did you go to?
And loving it. I ended up going to San Antonio College, got my first 50 hours or so, and then transferred to UTSA, and would drive all the way out to UTSA, and would do it in between my work. During that period, I was working in the legislature. That came about through my involvement in 1972, was the first year that we went to single member districts at the legislative level for Bexar County and several other counties in the state. Prior to that, it had been elections at large. So that year in 1972, a friend of my dad's was running for the legislature, Joe Hernandez. He's an attorney. At the same time, Matt Garcia, who's now deceased, an attorney, also was running for the legislature. Bob Vail, who's also deceased now and eventually served in the legislature and later the Senate, was running for the legislature. Although Vail, I believe, had been elected under the at-large system before, if I'm not mistaken. So we got real involved in the 1972 election. It was a fun campaign. It was a lot of work. I remember, I mean, I'm involved in the Clinton-Gore effort today and other campaigns. And I remember, right, you know, now you pick up the telephone, you order, hey, give me 1,000 signs, 4x8s, make it tricolor, and all this kind of stuff. In those days, we printed all our signs in the backyard. We hand printed them with doing the silk screening. And that was my job during that campaign. That was the major part of my job. Every campaign sign we used in the Joe Hernandez race, none of them were printed at a print shop. We did them all at a warehouse in the back, you know, in our backyard. It was fun, you know, it was a lot. I enjoyed it. And we got real involved in a campaign. And really, that's kind of what started me really getting into politics in terms of as a vocation or as a career, as a, you know, my trajectory to get involved and to eventually run for office.
because who did you work for at that time?
Well, let me tell you how it happened. It's kind of funny, and it's funny, but also I think it's telling about a person and about a relationship and about humanity in terms of how we deal with each other. I'm a young kid, 19 years old or so, working at a pharmacy, a few hours in college, and get involved in this campaign. Well, after the campaign, Joe Hernandez, who officed at the Tower Life building here, a large, a tall building downtown, says, I get a message through my dad that Hernandez wanted to see me. So on the given day, I go to his office, I sit down on the outside. And eventually, he calls me in, so I go into his office, I sit down on the sofa, and he says, well, he says, you know, I want to thank you for your help. And you and your dad and your family helped a lot. And, you know, we won. He squeaked by 14 votes in a runoff. He came in third. Through a recount, he ended up being second. With Jose Medellin, I believe, ran first. And then in the runoff, he won by 14 votes. I mean, you talk about one vote not counting. If 14 of us in the campaign had not voted, he would not have been in the legislature, and maybe I wouldn't be sitting here as a former councilman. But anyway, what happened, I walk in, you know, he says, thank you, and the campaign was great, you all did a lot of work, blah, blah. He says, by the way, I want to tell you that, you know, I'm going to need some help in the legislature in Austin, so I want to ask you if you'd be interested in working with me. And I noted that he said, with me, not for me. Well, he stunned me. I wasn't expecting that. And I said, I've never been to the Capitol. I don't know anything about the legislature except what I learned in the books in Texas history. This is the elected state representative, an attorney, just elected, getting ready to go be sworn in. He said, I don't know either. Let's go find out. So we go to Austin, you raise your hand, you know, and you're in. Today, you're elected to the legislature, there's an orientation program. In those years, there wasn't. You go figure out where the bathroom is. You pick up the telephone and figure out how the hell to file a bill and what the process is for filing a bill. It was interesting. It was great. It was a great opportunity.
Did you ever ask him later, why you? What did he see in you?
You know, I haven't. I never did. You know, Joe and I continued to remain friends, and we you know, we visit on a lot of things, but I don't know. I don't know why.
What did you do for him then when you got to Austin?
Well, it was a whole new world. It was like you're in the legislature now, and you're a legislative aide, and you're gonna file bills, and you're gonna work the committees, and you're gonna do hearings, and you're gonna do, you know, get witnesses, and you're gonna run the district office, and you're gonna commute back and forth. And for 10 years I did that. I worked for Joe for 9 years, commuting back and forth to Austin, running his office here, staffing it here, handling his office budget. Really, it gave me 9 years of building a base where I knew every nook and cranny in District 57J, which I still have memorized here in my mind, and every parish and every, you know, neighborhood in that district that later became my council district.
Did you double dip? I mean that in a positive sense, that you used the staff position to also do the political work.
Yeah, the legislative staff, Joe's legislative staff, was very much a service-oriented staff. So by providing service, you were doing politics. By having a district office on the west side of San Antonio at the corner of Guadalupe and Brazos in front of the Guadalupe Theater, which I chose and said, that's where we want to be. Right in the heart of the barrio, because that's where the service is needed. That's where people have trouble with their food stamps. That's where they have trouble with the state agency, regulatory agencies, and we were right in the heart of it. And really, we filled the void, because when Joe was elected, Joe Bernal was defeated in the Senate, and Joe Bernal had an office on the west side, providing service to the constituents. When he was defeated, that went down, and really Joe Hernandez came in and filled the gap, filled the void. So we ran a very much service oriented.
Did you run his campaigns and get off the payroll at this time?
When he ran for re-election in those times, I would get off the payroll for a brief period of time, if I recall. But he never had a challenge again until his last year, he lost his last race to our current Attorney General, Dan Morales. but I think after once Joe got in, he never had another, challenging race.
Did you work his campaign when he lost to Dan?
No, in fact, when he lost to Dan Morales, I was running for the legislature in a different district. What happened is that after 9 years there, I was kind of at the point where I was ready to try to make a change. I was eager to maybe get into it and get elected and run for an office myself. Frankly, I would have liked to run for Joe's old seat, the west side of San Antonio, which was the district I grew up in and knew well. But Joe wasn't ready to move on. So what happened is after redistricting in 1980, we went through the legislative redistricting. Well, out of that process, some changes took place where an incumbent state legislator, Tommy Atkinson, vacated his seat and was going to run for the Senate. This was a swing district that included part of the west side of San Antonio, the near south side of the city, the King William area, out to Highland Hills and Pecan Valley. So it was a, quote, southeast Bexar County district. Very diverse. West side of San Antonio all the way to East Central School District and, agricultural area out there. Well, it was an opening. It was a swing district, maybe 58% population, Hispanic population. And I decided to run for it. That was my first run for the legislature at 31 years old in 1982. And there was, I think, 3 Anglo candidates and 2 Hispanic. I got into a runoff with an Anglo candidate by the name of Ron Bilbrey. His family owned, I think, the Bilbrey Lumber Company over there in that area. Sometimes you run and there's certain things that happen that just help make it possible for you to win. And I'm reminded of Victor Morales' race this year. But in my case, in my situation in 82, had I run heads up, one-on-one, Anglo against Hispanic, I would have lost. I would have never won. There was 13 Hispanic precincts in that district of 31 precincts. I won all 13, but cut into the others just a little bit. But because of the 3 Anglo candidates and the split in the vote, you're thrown into a runoff. Well, there was in the primary, there was a big turnout because Atkinson was running against Senator Coathman, a big challenge. Coathman had been in for years in the Senate. So there was a big, huge turnout. Had I run against an Anglo candidate, I would have been wiped out. But there was a runoff. We go into the runoff. Well, the Senate race is over. The Anglos go fishing. I get out my Chicano votes in the 13 precincts and cut a little bit into the Anglo, and I win by 400 votes.
Did you get support of any of the others who would run? Did you go seek out the Anglos, or did you go do any campaigning in the Anglo precincts? Some of that is black, no? Going across?
Very little. No, in that district, it's only like 3%. Very little. It's only mostly basically Anglo and Hispanic. I did campaign in the Anglo precincts. I went to the doors, I knocked on the doors, but that is a very old Anglo entrenched district. Frankly, it's a lot of redneck country, and a lot of nice people too, but I don't remember the exact percentage I picked up in there, but it's a tough district. It's a swing district, and I knew it, but we were successful. I got elected.
How did you raise your money then? On your own for the first time? I'm sure that you raised money for Joe, but that was different. You're raising money for an incumbent. There's traditional sources. How did you do it now as an upstart in this uphill battle?
It was primarily family and friends, close friends. I mean, people, the guys that I went to Lanier High School that were raising hell in the walkouts, And he's the Edgar Lozano's, and others. And then over 9 years of working with Joe Hernandez, the many associates and the legal community and people that knew me because of my involvement as the assistant who took care of the day to day, you know. You meet a lot of people. 9 years to build a base. Although my base was over here on the west side, you know, you meet people from throughout the city, throughout the county. If I'm not mistaken, it took us about $35,000, which is not bad. I mean, considering campaigns, that's probably very cheap, very low. In fact, most of my legislative races were about $30,000. When I ran for the city council later, it was around $30,000 that we spent to run a district race. I guess it wasn't until I ran for county commissioner when I left the city council, and that was a race that I lost. We got 48% of the vote on that, and that one, that was a challenge, because here I am a city councilman, I decided to run for the county, and I knew that it was going to cost me $100,000. In fact, I said it publicly, we're going to run a $100,000 campaign. Privately, I was wondering, how the hell am I going to raise $100,000? But we did, and it was an interesting way that we did it too. But the legislative campaign, fundraisers, you know, $25 a pop, $50, $100, $250. It was mostly small contributions. I think my largest contribution was probably $500 at that time, when I ran for the legislature. Well, I served one session, which I felt was, you know, very successful. I'm representing a very diverse district. I mean, from King William, the historic district, to the west side of San Antonio, to Highland Hills and Pecan Valley. But the session's over, and 2 years later, in 84, I'm running for re-election. Atkinson, who had lost his Senate bid against the incumbent Kaufman, decides, well, I need the seat back for a stepping stone to run again for the Senate in 2 years. I mean, I predicted that, and eventually that's what happened. He came back, took his seat from me. There was no one, and today there is no one that can beat Tommy Atkinson in that district if he wants it. I mean, he's in.
Why is that? Why does he have such a hold and such a powerhouse?
Well, he's very active in the Highland Hills area, Pecan Valley, and that district is still to this day a swing district, but dominated by the Anglo population, and a few precincts that are Hispanic. But you know, the turnout and the turnout doesn't compare. But Atkinson does a lot of, to his credit, does a lot of neighborhood work and is very active. You know, today that's held by a Hispanic by the name of Robert Puente, who's an attorney. Well, he's an ally of Tommy Atkinson's. If they weren't allies, he wouldn't be elected. He wouldn't be a state representative. That's my prediction. So anyway, what happened is that Atkinson came back, ran, beat me. It was 1-1, no runoff, no nothing. So I think he beat me like 1,000 votes. I mean, it was solid. He gets elected. 2 years later, he gives up the seat again to run for the Senate, this time against Frank Tejeda. Lost again. But by that time, 1984, I lose my race. In the fall of 84, by this time, I'll back up, I had been married 5 years, my first wife, Marta.
Where is she from, and where did her
Marta
parents
grew
come
up? We met at Lanier High School. Her brother was a buddy of mine from high school, and we married in 1979, I believe. We were married for 5 years.
Did you date her when you were in high school?
After high school, she was younger than I am, and we were married for 5 years. She was she worked. In fact, we got married. She worked for the state. In fact, she worked for Joe Hernandez's office at one time before we were married, and in 84, when I lost my race for the re-election for the legislature, and that fall, we ended up separating. We ended up getting a divorce later in spring of 85. And in the fall of 84, I was kind of debating what I wanted to do politically. I had lost my race for the legislature. I guess it was late in the fall of 84 and early in 85 that I gave real serious thought to running for the council, city council. I had never...
Before you go off on that, let's go back to the legislature. Do you remember participating in the caucus?
I have
a couple of questions to ask.
Sure, the Chicano caucus.
Yes, I wanted to ask you the process, how that worked. How did you feel with this group? Did you all act cohesively? What are some of the problems with the caucus, the personalities? The other question I want to ask you is, now you are your own person, your own state rep. How does a freshman make things happen for them? Of course, you had a lot of experience. Is it that you got to be with the speaker, you got to tie in with the good old boys? What did you think of the women, Mexican women who were there about that time? Irma Rangel doesn't come in until 1978. It's a little
bit later, Irma.
She comes in 1978, no?
Yeah, in 70, yeah, well, she was there in 82. I got elected in 82.
Okay, so you meet the first Mexican-American women. Those are the kind of questions about the legislature I wanted to ask you.
Well, it was, first of all, you know, after 9 years working as an assistant, I was getting kind of fed up with it. I really wanted to make a move or make a change. But the minute you're elected and you're in the driver's seat, it's like new life, new energy. So you're ready to hit it. And the caucus was very active. We had leadership in the caucus at the time. I'm trying to remember. I know that, you know, Gonzalo Barrientos and Matt Garcia. I'm trying to remember. I think Matt Garcia died right about 83, I think, because I got elected. Matt was still in the legislature, and I think he died a year later. And Orlando, his assistant, succeeded him. And Orlando and I, who, you know, Orlando's now a federal judge, we kind of grew up in the legislature because he working for Matt and me working for Joe Hernandez. You build friendships and relationships with the assistants of the other legislators. But once I got elected, I worked, you know, the caucus was pretty united. I don't remember who the chairman of the caucus was at the time. It might have been Chuy.
Al Luna?
It might have been Al Luna and Chuy, you know, Rosa and those people, you know, from the Valley, and Al from Houston. And yeah, and then later Roman Martinez came. And, you know, those years fade when there's so many personalities and you forget which one came when. But the speaker was Gibb Lewis, and Hugo Berlanga was the speaker pro tem, I believe, even back then. And we had pretty good access to the leadership, through I think the caucus and the individual members. If, you know, you wanted to get to the speaker, get to have access, you know, he was pretty open, but having direct access. And, you know, there was, I remember that that was the year we passed for the first time the Civil Rights Commission, the State Civil Rights Commission, the formation of, which I think had been attempted for like 10 years. I remember we voted on the short handle hoe, which I think Joe Bernal had introduced 20 years earlier. I think it took 15, 20 years to pass, you know, the outlawing of the short handle hoe. I mean, totally incredible. There was some other school finance reform bills.
What committees did you get on?
I got on, I was on, they weren't the best. I got on County Affairs Committee. I was on the Retirement and Aging Committee. We were dealing with nursing homes, I remember at the time. I believe those were the two.
What committee was Joe on?
Joe Hernandez. He was on criminal jurisprudence. Very involved in criminal justice matters and prison reform. You know, that was one of the major committees he was very active in, and I'm trying to remember what the other one was. He was active in the formation of that interim committee on jail standards. At the time, that was about during the era of the Reese lawsuit, and lawsuits for, you know, conditions in jails. We were real busy that interim. I remember in this study, it was a joint House and Senate committee on jail standards. And what other committee did he have? There was another one. I can't remember which that was.
Did you collaborate with him at this time? I mean, are you still allied solidly, or are you walking your own path?
No, it's kind of funny. I remember a little. You know, you're in politics and you're a politician, and you get slammed periodically by the paper here and there, and who knows where they pick up this stuff. But I remember I got slammed as being Joe's puppet, or that, you know, I wasn't on my own and did my own, which is totally ridiculous, because I mean, we were friends, and we may philosophically have a lot in common in terms of how we voted or how we feel about certain issues. But, you know, I wasn't checking to see how people were voting. I mean, I'd been in the legislature 9 years working there, and I was green when I got there. But, you know, after 9 years there, you kind of know which way it flows, you know. but anyway, that's part of the thick skin that you need in being in politics. If there's anything that I tell young people is that be prepared, because anything goes. And you got to be able to take it and just be, you know, keep going forward. And because they will attack, they will, you know, throw everything at you.
How does an environment like that corrupt a first termer, a young member?
Well, if you want to get corrupted, you know, it's easy. The lobby, the whining and dining, and the lobby is a very powerful. You know, entity. But you know, I think that if you have certain principles, and you believe in certain principles, and you know, you're going to vote your conscience, and you're going to represent the people that sent you there, and you know, you're not going to sell out for a mere, you know, dinner or, you know, trip to the golf course or whatever. I was pretty studious at the time in terms of the legislature. I mean, I remember living, and let me tell you how I lived. I first of all, you know, legislators aren't paid much, and if you're in the session, you're working. Of course, you can't hold another job over here. My first challenge was to figure out how I could afford an apartment up there, to represent my people in the legislature. Well, I couldn't afford one. I looked around, I couldn't find one. I mean, it was, I didn't want to pay what they were asking for. I couldn't afford it, I didn't have it. So, but I start snooping around, and well, I find out that a friend of mine has a house on the east side of Austin, just off First Street, just off 35. My friend is Richard Moya, a former county commissioner in Austin. So I go to Richard, hey, Richard, I understand you have a house in. Yeah, it's an old house, and you know, I got it there. It's empty, and I said, well, you know, I'm kind of looking around temporarily for something. And he says, well, you're welcome to it. I mean, you can use it, no problem, no cost. So I said, well, can I kind of look at it? And so I go and look at it, and basically, it's a nice house. It's maybe like a 2-bedroom and a kitchen and a living room, typical house that I would see on the west side of San Antonio, like in Monterrey or Saunders or whatever. And how Richard uses it is that during the campaign season, it is a campaign headquarters. So he lets all kinds of candidates use it, right? So he said, so I go back to him, I said, okay, look, so I'll tell you what, I can use it, and I'm just going to use one room, the bedroom, that's it, you know? And, but I got to give you something, I'm not going to take it for free. No, make it, you know? And he says, no, I got to, and I forgot what it was, it might have been $100 a month. said, at least for the utilities. I said, at least for the utilities. He said, okay, lo que quieras, whatever. So sure enough, I get an army cot, one of those aluminum frames that open up, and you know, with a green canvas, and I put the army cot in the room, and I had a little green box like this that they shipped toronjas in, the grapefruit from the valley, and that was my to put my clothes in, my underwear or whatever, and I would commute. See, I was married at the time, so what I would do is I would drive up Mondays, and I believe drive back. Then I drive up Tuesday and stay till Thursday and come back. Those were the nights that I had committee meetings. I would stay late. I would stay over there, stay overnight. Monday nights I had no committee meetings. I drive up, go to the session, whatever, do my work, and drive back that evening. Tuesdays I drive up again. So I had this sparse room, and that's where I lived while I was serving in the legislature. And so one night, so traditionally I would get home late. I mean, I would get home at 10, 11 o'clock at night. I mean, why be there in a, you know, simple room, you know? So one night I get home and I'm walking up the sidewalk and the light's on. And there's a lot of commotion and stuff in the living room area, because I would walk in like this, the living room, and then just walk to my bedroom like this and close the door. And the rest of the house, he had a printing press in the kitchen in the back, you know? And so, well, sure enough, I walk in and there's this 20 people meeting. And I said, what the shit's going on? And sure enough, it was a campaign. It was campaign season. They were running for city council in Austin.
He forgot to tell you.
He forgot to tell me.
He had loaned the rest of it to somebody.
The rest of it's being used. So I said, hey, don't mind me. I'm over here in this room. I won't bother y'all. Close the door. I walk. And they ran their campaign, and you know, but I would get there late. I told you I was pretty studious. I usually would stay at my office the nights that I was in Austin at the Capitol, in many cases till 11, 12 o'clock at night, reading, researching, doing my stuff, you know, you know, I enjoyed it. I mean, I was really into the work, and but it was interesting that I could, that's all I could afford, and that's the one, I guess, difficult thing in politics for minorities, for Mexicanos, you know, other people, young people. I run into young people and they ask me about, you know, they're excited about getting involved in politics. I said, well, first figure out how you're gonna eat. I mean, it's just basic, because it doesn't pay. I mean, most of the posts that you were going to run for, whether it's school board, city council, legislator, whatever, unless you get into the Congress, and even there, I think people have a difficult time because they got to maintain two households, one in Washington, one here. But I tell them, figure out how you're going to eat. Think about that first. And, you know, we have a city council here that I served on, and that I now see young people there serving on, and they have a hard time, $20 a week. Their wives are supporting them, or they have part-time jobs, and it's difficult. I can tell you, I can show you my credit history during the years that I served on the city council, and I can tell you, you can see the troubled years was when I was working hard trying to make ends meet, and working 85 hours a week, with probably 60 of that going to city council, and it was tough, and it's just tough. So, I mean, it's very realistic. Young people have to realize that you know, you got to figure out, can you hang a shingle out there or something? An attorney, what are you going to do?
If many others are in the same predicament, why doesn't it get changed?
Well, it's part of the, it's very difficult, you know, and even more difficult now because of the cynicism about politics and politicians. How are you going to change a city charter that requires a popular vote to pay the council people? I mean, it's ludicrous. It'll never pass. I mean, it's just crazy. So in the meantime, you know, we get what we pay for. But people don't understand that. And, you know, reasonable people will understand it, but the masses and in general people feel like, you know, they're cynical about politics and politicians and paying them.
Let me try to close this legislature business, unless you got some other points. The first women who got there, how were they treated? Mexican-American women,
how
effective were they?
Yeah, I remember Irma Rangel and who else was there at the time, Hispanic women. I remember a black woman, Symphonia Thompson, and another one from Austin, but I can't remember if Irma was the only one. I believe she was. And Irma, I think they were just as effective as men. Irma was kind of a novelty in that among the Chicano legislators, because she was treated very affectionately. What I mean by that is, you know, Irma is a character who, I think her favorite term is mijito. And, you know, everybody is a mijito. And, you know, I think she's just a very lovable person, character-wise. And I remember she and Matt Garcia were desk mates, and they had a very, very close and positive relationship. And, you know, I think they were treated with respect, and I think as equals, at least in my views. I mean, I always have felt that way about, you know, women in general. I did not have a lot of dealings with Irma Rangel, but I knew her well, and whenever I needed anything, and, you know, like as I said, you know, there was a camaraderie, and I think the camaraderie among the Chicano legislators extended to including the Chicana, the Irma Rangel. It was, you know, and you had, you also had the nuances of the Chicano legislators with a somewhat of a division or identification, in that there was a Chicanos and then there was the others that were maybe kind of borderline. You know, and even in terms of things like, well, were they the Chicanos that sat in Red Square on the floor of the House? Or were there the Chicanos that sat on the other side of the aisle with some of the whites and the Republicans? And it was kind of interesting how, you know, where you sat and what group you hung with identified what kind of legislator you were going to be, or you were, you know. Red Square, you're familiar with Red Square. There was a during that era, and the Gibb Lewis era, and I don't know if it's still referred to as that, but there was this kind of Chicano patch out there, and black African American legislators, and that was referred to as Red Square in the left rear of the chamber. It was kind of funny, but you know, I thoroughly enjoyed my career in the legislature. I can tell you that having served in the legislature first, it's kind of weird because Henry B. Gonzalez was elected to city council, then later went to the legislature at the Senate level. Well, I started the legislature, but the rationale is I was working for a legislator, and that was my beginnings of in politics. Then I came back home and ran for the city council. I enjoyed the legislative process, and I would even consider going back one day, maybe to the Senate. It's a very powerful institution, and particularly the Senate. When you have 31 senators, and we now have, for example, of the 31, I think 7 Hispanic, you know, the senators are almost, you know, like, they're like next to God. They're pretty close up there.
Can we pick up the second wife? When did you get married again? Who is she? Where'd she come from?
Well, my wife is Susana Sosa, from Laredo, Texas. Her family's from Laredo. We got married, 9 months ago, last year, in October, although I met her, we had been seeing each other for maybe 6 years before we got married. I think I met her, around 19, I was on the city council, and it was probably 1990, 89, 90. And I remember the night I met her and where it was and everything. It was during Fiesta Week here in San Antonio. I just finished. It was on Saturdays, you have the night parades, and the council people used to be invited to be part of that. So I just gotten off the parade and went to have a little drink at Mi Tierra, at the mariachi bar. And that's where I met her. But that was an interesting night, the parade and just being involved in the council. You know, when I got elected to the city council, I got elected in 1985.
Well, why did you decide to run for that? I hear you got defeated. You probably didn't waste much time with depression and bitter thoughts.
And divorce.
And all of that.
Went through divorce, yeah. And it was spring of 85. And let me tell you what happened. I had never planned to run for the city council. Because I knew la chinga que era. I mean, it's just... I knew it was a lot of work. And
less money.
Very difficult. And the incumbent at the time that got elected in 1977, the legislature went to single member districts in 72. The city council went to single member districts in 77. I know that because my dad was the named entity. It was Martinez et al. Versus Charles L. Becker and the city of San Antonio. It was a lawsuit filed by MALDEF to try to force single member districts.
Your dad was a plaintiff? Or one of the plaintiffs?
One of the plaintiffs.
But it carried his name?
It carried his name. And this was back in, it went into effect 77, but this was filed probably like in 74. And when I was working for Joe Hernandez in the legislature, one of the first bills Joe filed in successive years was to force single member districts for city council in San Antonio. Of course, the bill never passed, but it was pressured through the legislature, it was pressured through the courts, and it was political pressure in the Justice Department. And finally, the city council here, at the time led by Lila Cockrell, agreed to put up a measure on the ballot and allow the people to vote. Well, it squeaked by maybe 1,500 votes or a couple of thousand votes. But we got single member districts. So a new council is elected for the first time. Bernardo Dest is the incumbent representing District 5. He got elected. Henry Cisneros is the mayor. Frank Wing is on the city council. Joe Webb from the east side, black community. Helen Dudmer from the southeast, and a few others. So everything's going fine, you know, since 77, and this cast of characters pretty much were entrenched. I mean, they were, this was the era where there was no term limits, and, you know, from 77, 79, 81, 83, 85. So Bernardo Ureste was in, he was an 8-year incumbent, and I'm driving down Laredo Street on the west side of San Antonio, in front of my alma mater, Frank Johnson Elementary School, in El Barrio de la Tripa, because of the packing house district, everybody knows it. And my dad's driving his van, and I'm sitting in the driver's seat, and I think we're going to have some tacos over at Piedras Negras restaurant. And I look over to him, and I said, you know, it was probably around January, and I said, you know, I think I'm thinking about running for the city council. And my dad looks at me, and he takes a double look, and he says, are you sure you want to do that? And I said, I don't know yet. I'm thinking about it. So we started talking. I decided to run because I was unhappy with what I was hearing and what was happening at City Hall. Let me back up a little bit. In 77, when Bernardo Ureste ran for the first time for single member districts, along with these other folks, my father was in that race.
As a candidate?
As a candidate. There were 8 candidates in that race. My dad came in 4th. He decided to run the last day, filed, you know, his friends urged him to run. This was the first run after single member district, you know, with single member districts. And keep in mind, my dad's always been involved behind politically in the, you know, he was part of this lawsuit. he's always been very active. So he lost to Bernardo. After he lost, in fact, he endorsed Bernardo in the runoff. And we supported him actively for a number of elections. But in 85, some things had happened, one of the things I felt was that Bernardo's attention was no longer, his focus was no longer the district and what he was trying to do, and doing something for the district and for the constituents. Furthermore, I felt he had just gotten off tangent completely on some issues that were occupying his time, and I was pissed off. I felt like District 5 was the laughingstock of the city. And I said, so I decided to run because I wanted to change that. I was unhappy with it. I said, well, if you're unhappy with it, do something about it. So I think I was $4,000 in the red from the previous campaign. Bernardo Deste and I shared common support. We were active in his races. So many of his supporters were my supporters in the legislature. I knew I was going to split that. I knew that many of those that had helped and were committed to Bernardo would stay with him. And in fact, some did. I can name you people that are my friends even today that came to me and said, Walter, we've been with Bernardo, we can't leave him. So, and my comment to them was, no problem, I understand. A few came with me and many of them stayed with him. It was a rough campaign. We never got into personalities.
But you didn't have to. He was scandal ridden by that time.
Yeah. It was more, I didn't have to do that. You're right.
You had a nickname of Benny the Chicken.
Yeah. Besides, it's like, why poor? I remember that, in my district, in this district, COPS was very active. The COPS organization, and I went to the COPS meetings, and I could see it in the viejitas, in the eyes of the viejitas. They wanted some change. The viejitos, they loved Benny, and let me say, Benny did a lot of good. I'm not gonna knock him down. He did a lot of good, and he fought for a lot of issues, those were battles that were needed. But he got off. He fell off the wagon. He just was playing around doing all kinds of stuff. And I sensed that the gente, they were ready. They wanted someone. So, the beauty of it is that I did not go to them as an unknown quantity. I had already been elected to the legislature. They had already voted for me in some sense. A few people knew of me. So it was two well-known quantities. So it was not a... I had some name ID, not as much as Benny's, but I had some. We probably spent about $35,000. I remember that during those years, you could still go to the bank and borrow $20,000 you had some nice good friends that would sign for you. And we co-signed, about four of us, and we borrowed $20,000, which was a quick, zap, because it was a 5-week campaign. It was like fast.
Which bank?
It was NBC, National Bank of Commerce, and my good friend Narciso Cano, and my dad, and myself, and an attorney friend of mine, we co-signed. I don't think I paid off that $20,000 loan. I made payments on it. I don't think I and renegotiated it. Excuse me, just a minute. But I don't think I paid it off till. I think I finished my 7-year stint on the city council, and I paid my final payments on that damn loan after seven years in my whole city council career. All the time having to raise money for more campaigns, for other elections, for re-elections. But it was a good campaign. It was well run. It was my nephew Fernando was the kid involved in that campaign. It was family.
Let me ask you, in San Antonio politics, you were involved by that time in many campaigns. Are there, like in regions of the state, like in South Texas or in Laredo, The political workers who have their list, and you go to them, or some of the preachers in the African American community, you know, you go to them and you say, I need you to help me out with 100 votes or 1,000 votes or the votes that you've got, and they pretty much agree that their volunteer time and their expenses are going to run $3 a person or $5 or $10. Sometimes they call them comares.
Coyotes.
Coyotes, all right. Does that phenomenon exist in San Antonio politics, and are there people that are identified as such?
It exists to a certain extent, but I don't think not to the point where it's like, well, it's $3 a head or whatever. And frankly, it does exist to some extent where certain people say, well, you know, I've got my route and I've got my van and we pick up the viejitos and we do this and we do that. It's more loose, and there are some people that are real active like that. Like I have a friend, Morales, who is Arturo, works with the elderly a lot. So yes, he has lists and he has conocencias con ellos. And it's not a per head thing, but it's like, if I were to decide today that I'm going to run for the Senate, he'd be one of the first calls I make, and I say, Arturo, will you help me, blah, blah, will you? And it's like, está bien, you know, I'll be with you, and we'll work together, and, you know, and he'll need gas money, he'll need this, he'll need that, and it's not a lot of. There's others that will tell you they have all kinds of lists, and that they can deliver all kinds of votes, but you know who those people are, and you know that they can't deliver. And those are the coyotes I would call. But you don't turn them off. You work with them. You deal with them. No les sueltas, you know. Tienes, pero you gotta tienes que soltar algo, you know.
Yeah.
And you don't make an enemy. You know. I mean, you keep them on your side. You work with them. But you know, you're not crazy. You're not gonna write them a check for $1,000. I mean, there's some idiots that will come to you, and I can name a couple of idiots that will come to you. And I mean, they're serious. They think they're worth $3,500. Give me a break. No way. I mean, that they're taking you. They can't deliver. But it's not to the extent that, you know, listas and per head, and not that extensive.
In the course of all these campaigns, did you do voter registration? Did you have a connection with Willie Velasquez?
And oh yeah. In fact, Willie encouraged me to run for the city council. Let me tell you something. My decision to run against Benny Ureste and my decision to run for city council was a very, very difficult decision. One, I was not happy with what was going on, so I wanted to change that. Number two, I had to be convinced personally that challenging Benny Ureste and running against Benny was something that I was convinced I was doing for good reasons, and that there was support for that. By that I mean, I made some phone calls. I mean, I talked to some people, a lot of people, and there had to be confirmation that, no, you know, you're not crazy, or yes, you know, it's probably time that, I mean, there's nothing wrong with you running for it. I mean, I had to converse with some of my, people that I respect in politics and people that I respect for their involvement and for what they've done. I mean, I started with my father in La Calle Laredo when he's driving down, and he looks at me twice. A call to Joe Bernal, a visit with Willie Velasquez, and several other people like that. And after getting encouragement or confirmation that, you know, dale gas, you know, that's when I did it. I also did it and decided to run with a commitment that was not just a knockoff Benny Ureste and then, you know, I drop it this was a commitment. And I said to myself, it's going to be 6 to 8 years minimum that I will do this. I have to commit myself financially, otherwise, that for 6 to 8 years I will go, because that's how long it's going to take to make some changes over there and to accomplish some things that I wanted to accomplish. And it turned out to be 4 terms, 8 years. I served 7 because I decided to step down in my last year. because I saw an opportunity to run for county commissioner. I was, after 7 years on the city council, and let me say this, we now have limited terms, which I disagree with. I don't think we need to limit terms at all. I think the people limit you. And I think that's the way it should be. It's sad. I think we're hurting ourselves long-term, big time. But I think that an adequate period to make a difference over there is probably about 8 years. After 7 years, I felt I had accomplished a lot of things that I wanted to accomplish there at City Hall. Frankly, the limited term amendment had already passed, so even if I had wanted to run for re-election, I was prohibited. However, personally, I had kind of come to my end with City Hall, in that the grind, the time it took, the time away from concentration and family, business, financially. So my feeling was, it's time to try to move on. I still wanted to serve. I still felt that not only did I want to serve, but I felt that I had learned in 7 years at City Hall. I learned a lot in terms of city government, urban development. I attended many of these National League of Cities conferences. They were very insightful for me. I'll give you one instance that I thought about it. That became one of my major. Remember some of my supporters when I ran for re-election. I beat Benny. 2 years later, Benny ran again, and I had another opponent, made this pretty stout opponent. So I had to work hard for a re-election. My first race, I won by 52% of the vote. The second race by 53% of the vote, with no runoff. And then thereafter, it was higher. The last two terms. Where was I?
You were going to tell me a story about a trip to a National League of Cities.
Yeah, you know, I remember one of my supporters says, when I'm running for re-election, hey, you know, you got to get, you know, you're not known for anything at City Hall. You've been there 2 years, and it's like, you're not the champion of this. You're not the, you know, they're going to come after us, and they're going to do this. And it's like, you can't pretend to be something. I mean, you got to do it naturally, it's got to happen naturally. And my thinking was, I was patient about it. I said, hey, I mean, different people are known for different issues, and a champion of this, the elderly, or whatever. And to me, it was like, it's going to come natural. You can't force this. You deal with the issues and you pursue. Well, eventually, we went through that and got reelected. And thereafter, I started picking up on this whole issue of small and minority business contracting. Here we are, a city of 1 million people. 52%, 55% Hispanic, and almost 60%, 63% minority. And 2% of the contracts at City Hall, a multi-million dollar budget, is going to minority-owned firms. I remember I was attending a conference in Washington, D.C., the National League of Cities, and they had these great workshops, a lot of them, different kinds, you know, on trash pickup, on energy, on all kinds of things. One of them was small business contracting, minority contracting. And I go into this hall, and I sit down, and I go in early, and there's going to be a panel and a moderator, and I sit down, and the hall's almost empty, and it starts filling up, and people are walking in, and right about the time, and then the panelists come up, and I recall that all the panelists were black, and one of them was white. I think the moderator. And right before the panel starts, I look around and look back. And everybody in the hall is African American. I don't see a single Mexicano. And maybe five whites sprinkled in a room full of 100 people. And I said...
And they were females.
Many of them were. And I said, and I'm active with HELO, Hispanic Elected Local Officials. That is a subgroup of the National League of Cities, Chicanos that get active, like the caucus in the legislature. And I said to myself, where the hell are my people? What the hell's going on? That turned me on to the whole issue of small and minority business contracting. I started researching it. I got a hold of, you know, there was a U.S. Supreme Court opinion, Richmond versus the Croson versus the city of Richmond. The Supreme Court ruled, I think, in 89 or 90. I started educating myself on the issue. What is this? How does it work? And so the issues came naturally. I became known for my championing of that issue. I ended up becoming, on a separate matter, I also did a lot of work with the elderly. And I think that stemmed from my upbringing with my grandparents, my grandfather, my great aunts, and the nutrition program for the viejitos. It was a favorite of mine. I mean, and I would go visit them. I had probably 8 nutrition sites in my district. They knew me well. And I think it started with my first campaign when I ran, because I saw it in their eyes and I saw how, you know, the viejitos really come out and vote. I mean, they are active and they stay. They may not know all the little specifics of the issue, but they are watching you. They know what's going on at City Hall. And I fought for funding for those programs. And but on the minority contracting, I ended up coming back. And you know, if there's one thing I'm proud of, that's one of the things. You know, it was needed. Came back, fought for a policy. The city fathers of San Antonio, you know, the 9th largest city in the country, with the first popularly elected in modern times Hispanic mayor, Henry Cisneros, did not have a policy where the city fathers had said, it is our policy to try to encourage subcontracting and contracting with minority and women-owned firms. Give me a break. I mean, we were 15 years behind Atlanta, 15 years behind Philadelphia, Detroit. I mean, it was sickening. I couldn't believe it. So, not that efforts hadn't been made individually and at staff level and things like that, but I felt it was important that the mayor and the city fathers of the city say, this is our policy, because then that translates to the private sector and the USAAs and the Valeros and the Southwestern Bells of the world and HEBs then say, well, you know, we have to probably look at that too.
So what were you able to crack open, and where did you fall short in this area contracting?
Well, you know,
there's a lot of criticism, for example, that I've heard. You tell me if it's true or not, because you had life under Henry and life without Henry. That under the mayorship of Henry Cisneros, minorities did not do well because he was not supportive of that. That minorities do better when there is a white mayor, that they can use that specter as leverage.
There's some truth to that. There's some truth to that. And I think regardless of what characters you're talking, whether it's a Cisneros, whether it's a, you know, a Gonzalez or whatever. I mean, I think there is some basic realistic truth to that statement. I mean, just the realistic leveraging that exists in politics, because, you know, people have to be responsive or whatever. Henry had, and let me tell you another thing. I feel that, you know, I mean, I take nothing away from Henry. I think he did a great job. I think he brought a lot to the city and attention, and he did address a lot of issues that were important. But at the same time, I will tell you that the Hispanic community and Hispanic leaders, business-wise and others, probably prodded that mayor less than they would prod another. And it was like, you know, well, you don't want to, you know, overturn the apple cart. So there is some truth to that. The issue that I pursued on this small minority business contracting is interesting the way it happened, because it was kind of almost coincidental. I was educating myself on the issue and coming up to speed on it, and at the same time, Henry forms this small business committee to promote San Antonio. Not minority, small business committee for economic development. He was a great vendor, promoter of economic development. Well, this small business committee was a small business and local San Antonio business type of thing, promotion. Well, under that auspices, the issue of minority contracting arises through the chambers, Hispanic chambers and others, you know, lightly, very lightly. I was not on that committee. I wanted to be on, and I wasn't appointed. by Henry. But I followed the committee. I followed it closely. I mean, I'm one vote on the city council, and eventually that committee comes back to the city council. So, bottom line was this. Committee came out with a report. I felt it was milquetoast. It didn't bite into the issue strong enough. And it wasn't gonna, it wasn't proposing an ordinance that would say, this is our policy. So I offered amendments. It's all documented in the newspapers. I've kept track of that. And bottom line, I was fought by the Greater Chamber of Commerce, by the Northside Chamber. And if I can speak candidly, it's sad that there was even an attempt to try to undermine my effort by the Hispanic Chamber. Certain leaders at that time. Others were with me, but at the time, and it's sad, they weren't successful. What happened is that sometimes you just react from gut, and I think I feel fortunate that in politics and in my career, you don't know why you do things sometimes. It's just, you know, you got to do this. I began to build a support network so that, I mean, eventually I'm going to push this to council, and I'm going to need 6 votes on the city council out of 10 votes in the mayor, 11. And so we developed a data bank, and I had Hispanic businessmen and African-American businessmen and architects and engineers and women and, you know, small business, and started communicating directly to them and getting them involved in the issue. I remember I had a breakfast meeting at Mi Tierra, and one of my strong proponents or supporters was a Cuban Republican, Damaso Oliva, Dr. Damaso Oliva, who was a staunch supporter of what I was pushing for. And I remember that at the same time I was having my breakfast, the Greater Chamber of Commerce and the Hispanic Chamber were trying to broker a deal with Henry C. to get Henry not to go with my program. Well, Henry saw what was happening, and bottom line, he said, Martinez has a good program, I'm gonna support it. It came to the city council. I will tell you that I walked into the city council the day that we passed that ordinance for small minority business contracting, setting a policy and setting goals. My point was that I wanted to push it to where we would actually set a goal. And the goal we set was 32% for professional contracts. And that was fought. It was, well, you know, you don't want quotas. This is not a quote, it's a goal. If we miss it, we miss it. We try harder the next year. And I knew that Richmond and Croson versus Richmond was in the Supreme Court. And my politically, my strategy was I wanted to push it to the edge without going over the edge, period. That was it. And the edge was, it's got to be voted on, it's got to be a policy, and I want it to be a state of goal. The day I walked into city council, if my life depended on it, I would say that I had 4 votes, including my own. I got a 10-1 vote. One city council member, Northside Anglo, voted against it. The mayor and everyone else voted for it. But I would not bet my life on it.
Okay. I mean, what did you not know about this intelligence of the votes?
Well, it's a sensitive issue, and although I felt that, you know, well, I think Henry will stick with me and he'll support me, and I think others will, you know, vote with me. It's one of those things where it was like, I mean, you never know on a vote until the last minute.
You didn't ask Henry personally for a vote?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, you know, they may say yes, but what the hell does that mean until it happens?
I see.
But I'll tell you what did it, and this is what I mean by the gut. You looked out in the chamber. Black faces. Brown faces, women faces, the chamber was packed. We had 300 people in there.
Did you help orchestrate that?
That was my data bank. That was my, you know, and my point to them at the breakfast on Monday morning and city council meetings on Thursday. at the breakfast on Monday morning, when I know that behind my back, some people are saying, let him wither out there on the left wing in the wind, and we'll cut the deal over here and we'll agree to a consensus. Well, that went by the wayside. But I told the folks, and these are people that, you know, if some are small business, some have never done business with the city, some have done business, and they're a little afraid to step up to the plate and say, well, you know, here I am, an engineering firm, I've got this project, the city's, I'm doing this for the city, and I'm criticizing the city, or I'm saying that we should be, there should be an order, you know, there's a little pressure on that. What I told them was this. I said, look, it's not gonna pass unless you guys help me with it. And we gotta pack that chamber. And I tell you what, you may not be able to go, but you know, you employ seven people in your firm. Send those seven faces over there. Sit them in the audience. Well, it was packed. Many of them that did business with the city came too. And I said, and I'm not gonna ask any of you to sign up and speak at the podium. You don't have. If you wanna do it, that's up to you. But I'm not gonna ask you to do it, to go on the record. 32 people signed up. Of the 32, two Anglos spoke against it, representing the Greater Chamber, the Northside Chamber. One Hispanic tried to reduce it or amend it, the one of the leaders of the Hispanic Chamber, and everybody else spoke in favor of my proposal.
Let me ask you, just as an aside but on point, psychologically or symbolically, how does that packed audience impact on the council member sitting there? I mean, so what? They're going to go away.
Well, but I think it makes it more difficult. I mean, here you are, you know, a Hispanic city councilman, a Hispanic female city councilwoman, a Hispanic mayor of a major urban city, and to vote on something in a vacant chamber that will be reported in the media later, maybe, and who knows in what, you know, what nuance they put on it, versus to vote right there in front of your peers, in front of your associates, people you know, you know, it's a big difference, and I think it was important. I mean, why is COPS effective? Because they packed the chamber, and if you're going to vote against them, it's going to be right there in front of them. So I didn't orchestrate this. I mean, you know, I didn't plan this. This was not a plan, a strategy. As you go along, hey, you know, you just react and you start putting it together, because you know that you're going to need this effort, this strategy, this whatever, and it just evolves, you know, as you go along. I had other votes on similar type sensitive issues, but you know, and sometimes you lose, sometimes you don't have it.
Let me ask you, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't there still some gaping holes? The convention center concessions can be broken, the advertising contracts, Atkins still has a stronghold on all of that.
Oh, yeah.
And there's others. Why does that continue to maintain the dynasty of families?
Well, yes, there are a lot of areas that still need change. You know, let me tell you one thing that I, you know, now being in the private sector and having a business, we manage apartments. I formed a company 4 years ago, which is kind of interesting. I during my council days, I got very active in affordable housing, and never thought I would end up pursuing a real strong business in that area, but that's what I'm doing now, managing housing. After I left council and lost my race for county commissioner, Governor Richards also appointed me to the Texas Department of Housing and Community Affairs, so I serve on that board, and I'm on my last year. It's going to be 5 years. Basically doing what I did on the city council with federal funds and CDBG and community development and housing, but doing it at the state level with pueblos pequeños como Laredo and, you know, Eagle Pass and Abilene and things like that. But the gapping hole, let me just say this, one observation that I have from being outside the city council now, or outside politics to some extent, or the private sector. One of the problems, one of the obstacles, confronted by the Hispanic businessman or businesswoman is the tendency for society to pigeonhole you. You know, oh yeah, Juan, he's a taco vendor. So-and-so, oh yeah, he does this. The Anglo businessman can be an entrepreneur. A Red McCombs car dealer, used car dealer, became a very successful car dealer, new car dealer. He can be the owner of the San Jose Spurs, but a Walter Martinez, the taco vendor from, come on. That is a problem. And I see it. You talk about major contracts. I made a bid. I teamed up with a very successful, very credible businessman here in town, Tom Turner, multimillionaire. Built Sigmore Shamrock and sold it, that became Diamond Shamrock. I teamed up with him and went after the riverboat contract. Had been held by the Lyons family for 40 years. An exclusive concession, San Antonio River, the number one tourist attraction in the state, and they held that for 40 years, became millionaires, the owners of Casa Rio restaurant. Nothing to take away from them. They started the idea, but for 40 years, and for a major part of those 40 years, they held that contract with the city with no competition given to them. Renewed. No one else had a chance to afford it. It wasn't until the last two times that they had to compete for it. I was on the city council one year. When they competed for it, others competed, and I didn't vote for them, but unfortunately they got the contract for 7 years. And this last time it came up, about a year ago, I decided I'm going to put a team together, I'm going to go for it. But you are handicapped to some extent, by the fact that people say, well, he's in housing, how can he run a barge? I mean, I can't own if I want to own an engineering firm, I can't own one. If I want to own a pharmacy, I can't own one because I'm not a pharmacist. So to some extent, you're handicapped because you're pigeonholed as a, you know, taco vendor. To another extent, let's talk the political. In that process, we didn't win, we came in third. And in that process, my political involvement really was a handicap. If you read the papers, or if you listen to what people say, well, you know, Martinez has an in because he's the former councilman and blah, 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 right? But at the staff level, staff will shy away from any controversy. So you may get the shaft, or you may get the lower points on the evaluation, because they don't want to deal with the political. They don't want to deal with the. So let's go with a team that has less political baggage or whatever. We competed against some heavyweights. The top three, the winner, eventual winner, was Dennis O'Malley, who has a local beer distributorship here. The one recommended by staff was the team that had less political involvement. Tom Turner and I headed one team. O'Malley and his wife, who used to work with the parks department, had political ties also. So the one that didn't have political ties or active political ties was a team headed by Harry Leeper, who owns a trolley company, who, by the way, happened to have Herb Kelleher money and family money, who had BK Johnson, as in the Hyatt money. I mean, they're heavyweights too, but less political. So I guess the point I'm making is, we got a long way to go, but it's, I think one of the things I see in the private sector, and let me say this, that this is not just the perspective from Americanos, from Anglo. I think our own people sometimes downgrade us. I think in some cases, Mexicanos look at another Mexicano and they say, well, wait a minute, you know, how can Jose Angel, you know, be part of this venture group that is attempting to do such and such? Well, why not? You know, we can't be entrepreneurs like anyone else. I think that's sad. I think we have to be more open-minded about those things. And as we succeed, I mean, my perspective is that, I think we have to work and help each other. Why should I hold it against another Mexicano because he's successful or he's venturing with in a major initiative or investment or development to build or to do or whatever? I mean, hey, more power to him.
So any personal comment about the two issues that I raised about the convention center and advertising? Is that why you're telling me the story about what happened to you?
Well, the convention center, the advertising contract, those are some of the juicy plums that have for years been gone to connected firms, and for many years have not involved. Like right now, the catering contract, Rosemary's Catering, she became a millionaire, and that's fine, and she does a hell of a job. She's a great woman. Does that mean that some other person, including a Mexicano in her place, could not have done the same thing? No, it doesn't mean it. I mean, I think she was given a great opportunity. Hemisphere 68, convention center is born, and she becomes the exclusive caterer for the convention center. Rarely had to compete for it. It's sad. No vision policy-wise from the small minority contracting, no vision policy-wise from the standpoint of trying to begin to grow a minority business. Why couldn't it have been Rosemary and a small initiative just to begin to grow in our community? I believe in either joint ventures or in initiatives where you bring people together. And you know, you may not necessarily kick someone out, but you begin to grow and open it up for opportunities like that.
The city council members get lobbied?
Sure, they get lobbied.
Is there an ethics policy or rules prohibiting gifts and expenditures and what goes on like in the legislature at the city council level here?
There is, and it's recent. It was passed, I'm trying to remember, but I believe it was passed even after, I think we had the first draft of an ethics policy when I was there. It was very minimal. I think after I left, a stronger one was passed. And in fact, I'll give you an example. When I left city council, there was no policy that said anything about the revolving door. When I left city council, the next day I could be contracting with the city. I personally imposed an ethics ordinance on myself by saying that when I left City Hall, I would not go back for a year for anything, for no contract or nothing. And I kept that promise to myself. I can tell you I have colleagues who, former colleagues of mine, who left City Hall and 2 months later were employed by the city. Not a headline in the newspaper about that. I would have gotten lynched in the papers and in the editorials. There's a double standard there too. And I can cite you specifics in terms of some of those issues like that. But yes, there is an ethics. And beyond that, we're also, city council members are also restricted by the state ethics laws in regards to reporting expenditures and contributions and gifts.
How much more time do you have to give?